Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Diana Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Max Oitman about his new book, Forging the Golden Urn, The Qing Empire and the Politics of Reincarnation in Tibet, published by the Columbia University Press in 2018. Using both archival sources in the Manchu language and chronicles of Tibetan elites, this book reveals the origins of the Golden Urn tradition, a Qing-era law mandating that the reincarnations of prominent Tibetan Buddhist monks be identified by drawing lots from a golden urn, as well as its implications in modern and contemporary geopolitics of Asia. Why was this tradition invented? What did this law mean to the Qing rulers and Tibetan Buddhists? Why was this law resurrected later by the People's Republic of China in 1995? These are some of the questions that this book explores while shedding new light on matters of sovereignty, faith, and law in the study of Qing frontier histories. Dr. Oitman, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good to talk with you.
Great. So Max, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. How did you become interested in East Asian and Inner Asian studies, and specifically in Tibet?
So that's a good question. I was, actually my interest in Inner Asia really began when I was an undergraduate at Carleton College in Minnesota. And, I had a really, amazing undergrad prof, but he didn't do Chinese studies. He did, the former Soviet Union and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, a guy named Adib Khalid. I remember taking his class on sort of the early Soviet Union, and he gave a lecture about how the Soviet Union had established or been, you know, part of this process of establishing independent states, or at that time Soviet republics, in Central Asia. And it came as like just a real revelation to me, the degree to which the Soviet Union had played such a major role in creating, really in creating nations, and how in early 1990s it was sort of bitten from behind by nationalist movements. Well, actually, not so much in Central Asia, certainly in the Balkans, but other places. But sort of how these sort of states had been created in that region, and the whole notion that countries in Central Asia had actually really complicated history was something I never encountered before and never been familiar with. And so, while I was an undergraduate, after kind of getting inspired there, I traveled in Central Asia, in Mongolia, and then in Siberia, Western China quite a bit, Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, and sort of got more and more interested in it after that. Just the landscape was impressive, and kind of just the people that I met on those trips and the hospitality that I received was pretty inspiring.
Oh, thank you for sharing your journey with us. Now, can you maybe tell us about how you came to write Forging the Golden Urn?
So I actually, I never really anticipated or imagined that I'd write a book about a golden urn. It sort of always seemed a little bit like a topic that wasn't all that interesting. And it's not something, it's not where I intended to end up when I began my dissertation research. Any kind of research when I was a PhD student. Actually, my original sort of direction in terms of academic research was in Xinjiang. And I'd spent a long time studying Uyghur through the early 2000s and into about 2007, 2008. My MA thesis was on Xinjiang. But around 2007, I really came to the conclusion that that Xinjiang studies was going to be a really hard field to continue working in. It was hard to find. I was really interested in social history, really, like sort of what was going on the ground in different places in the Qing period. And looking more and more and spending time in Xinjiang, I found it was very difficult to find sources about sort of the fine-grained daily lives of people in the 18th and 19th centuries, especially because in Xinjiang there was very little archival material that was available. Subsequently, I mean, we've had the publication of large numbers of Manchu language memorials from Xinjiang, which is beginning to give us an insight into its regions. But it was always going to be a very top-down Chinese or Qing-centered or Manchu-centered view of what was happening on the frontier, and that wasn't very satisfying to me. The other problem with continuing to do sort of Central Asian studies, as I thought, was that at some point you're going to have to learn not only Uyghur or Chagatai or other local languages, but you're definitely going to have to learn Russian. You're going to have to learn Persian and possibly even Arabic. And, you know, in midway or at the end of my MA, I really thought that was probably unfeasible. So I decided to turn more towards Tibetan studies, which I sort of thought was easier. I've been disabused of that notion now, but it seemed to me that you could, first of all, the exciting thing about doing research on Tibet or Tibetan regions of the Qing dynasty was that there were certainly lots of local level historical materials, chronicles, gazetteers, biographies, and even a variety of archival material. So in 2009, I was able to get access to a large number of archival sources from Qinghai, what's now Qinghai Province, the Qinghai Provincial Archives. So I was able to begin working with about 3,000 yuan or 3,000 fascicles of archival material from the late Qing, from the Guangxu period, from an office which had been set up in the Qianlong period, so in the 1760s, and had persisted down into 1912, this office called the Office of the Xunhua Subprefect, who had been responsible for governing or at least supervising a very multicultural region, part of Amdo. So there was Tibetans in there, there were Hui in there, there were Mongols in there. So it was very rich, like local source base, and the materials were in Chinese, but also in Tibetan, and many of the materials were in both Tibetan and Chinese, which was really fascinating. So in the first, this appeared to be unlike doing Xinjiang or other parts of Central Asia or other parts of the Qing frontiers, here was a region which had a rich historical base, and provided you could get a little bit of ability with Tibetan, then it seemed like it was possible to begin reading this material. So that's why I sort of moved from doing Central Asia more into Tibetan studies. This project with the Golden Urn, it really, I was working on a project primarily, and I'm still working on a project right now, which is about the legal history of Amdo or Qinghai and Gansu and parts of Sichuan from the 1600s all the way up to the end of the Republican period. So talking about local legal culture, how did it change? But in the midst of doing that project, I kept coming across materials about the Golden Urn and searches for reincarnate lamas or monks or choku. And that really surprised me, actually, because I had always sort of read or been under the impression that the Qing state was not particularly involved in searches for reincarnate lamas, that this thing I'd heard about once or twice before, the Golden Urn, this sort of lottery for identifying the authentic candidate was something which had been rarely used, and so on and so forth. So I was quite surprised, actually, to see a lot of materials about the Golden Urn, and actually just read in Manchu materials and in other archival documents coming out of Amdo, local Tibetans actually writing to the Qing state and requesting that the Qing state use this procedure. So I began to get a little bit curious about it. And when I began looking at the literature and turning back the page to the 1790s, when this ritual was initially invented, I found that there was lots of discussion about whether the urn was used or not, a little bit of discussion about why it had been created. But no one had really actually done any work to figure out where this whole thing had come from. Like, why did Qianlong or his officials actually come up with the idea of using a golden urn, a lottery, to solve problems or whatever problems it was that they perceived in Central Asia or Inner Asia? And the other question that really came to me was, well, what did they think was actually happening when they used this procedure, when they used this ritual? So it seemed like there was a lot of actually interesting questions that could be explored by talking or investigating the origins of this ritual.
Yeah, certainly. And this is kind of tying into our next question. And you point out in the introduction of the book that this project of the Golden Urn is to return to the original polyglots conversations of the Qing era, right? And test some of the longstanding assumptions about the Golden Urn tradition that have made from both scholars in the West and scholars in the People's Republic of China. What are some of the assumptions that your book and mythology is trying to challenge here?
As I wrote in the book, one of the underlying goals here is to recover the original script. So recover the original discussions about this procedure, both in the 1790s and then going on across the 1800s. And the reason for this is that this ritual, the Golden Urn, has become extremely, it was politicized, of course, in the 1790s and the 1800s, but it has a really different meaning in modern China and among exile Tibetans right now. So really the Golden Urn has become this very important symbol of Chinese nationalism, of the unity of a nation which was created in the early 20th century, or a nation which was reimagined in the early 20th century, this nation called the Zhonghua Minzu. So this broader sense of being Chinese. So the Zhonghua Minzu really is, of course, the kind of the Chinese nationalist solution to the problem that they perceived, in that you had the former Qing Empire, and it had a lot of different peoples. It had the Han Chinese in the former provinces of the Ming state. It had Mongols in Inner Mongolia and Outer Mongolia. It had the Manchu banner populations, Manchu Mongol and Han martial banner populations. It had Tibetans. It had all kinds of peoples. But it didn't really have a cohesive, single, unitary nation or nationality. And so the Zhonghua Minzu was the solution to that, sort of taking the word Chinese and expanding it to include all these other peoples. And so the Golden Urn has become, in my opinion, really a symbol of that Zhonghua Minzu Chinese nation. It's a symbol of the unity of Tibetans and Han as modern Chinese people. And so when you read Chinese writing about this, or at least mainland Chinese academic scholarship on this issue, it's not really something which they can question. It's not really something they're willing to probe the origins. This is an institution it's a symbol of the unity of the Chinese people, and therefore it's really not really politically correct to poke too deeply into the historical dustbin to figure out why this thing came into existence. Now, the other reason why it's extremely difficult to talk about this issue is because, of course, it's also a symbol of Chinese sovereignty, territorial sovereignty, and political sovereignty over Tibet. And and the argument made is that it was, it was used from the 1790s all the way down to the present, and Chinese scholars would say this is emblematic or symbolic of the degree to which Tibetans embraced the sense of being Chinese or being part of this greater Chinese people. And so these are all very, very anachronistic interpretations of what was happening in the 1800s and the late 1700s. So my goal really was to try to figure out, well, what really was going on, and what did China mean from the perspective of Tibetans writing in the 1790s or the early 1800s? What did Qing sovereignty really, what did it entail in those periods? There's also a lot of assumptions about how the Qing state or previous Chinese governments used Buddhism to attract the support and allegiance of different populations in Inner Asia, most importantly, the Mongols and the Tibetans. And it's sort of this understanding seems to me also quite overly simplistic. So, the idea here is that, the Qing state supported Tibetan Buddhism, therefore, and patronized monasteries and monks and incarnate lamas and established all these beautiful Tibetan Buddhist religious sites, both in Beijing, outside of Beijing, and across Inner Asia. And therefore, Tibetans just loved the Qing state, and they thought of themselves as Chinese somehow. I think that's all, highly problematic. And so I really wanted to figure out what actually was going on, especially because so much of our study about Qing period Tibet is really based on a set of institutions and objects that are in Beijing or at best maybe at Chengde, the summer palace, about 4 hours, train ride now north of Beijing. And I don't think that, the vast majority of Mongols or Tibetans ever visited these sites, right? So what did they actually learn about the Qing state? There's been too much emphasis, I think, on the structures and objects and architecture of Beijing in our understanding of just how it was that the Qing state established and sustained itself in Inner Asia.
And interesting. And from your revealing of this original polyglot conversation, a really interesting kind of approach emerges, one that it's taking the Qing Empire as colonial, right? So in the book, you also introduce the idea that, there is colonialism throughout the Qing kind of occupation of this vast lands combining parts of China proper and also Inner Asia. Can you tell us more about this approach and utilities in the book?
Yeah, indeed. So this is, I think that using the word colonial or colonialism to talk about Qing governance of Inner Asia, Inner Mongolia, Outer Mongolia, Xinjiang, and Tibet is definitely a loaded word. And one of the problems with using the word colonialism is it just does not translate very well into Chinese. So when I have conversations with scholars in mainland China, when you begin to talk about colonialism, it's such a pejorative term, and it instantly conjures up images of very Marxist interpretations of sort of high European imperialism and gross exploitation. And it fundamentally, assumes that the rule of the metropole over the periphery is illegitimate. So that's one package of interpretations of colonialism. But for me, I'm much more interested in the way that colonialism is used as an analytical tool in subaltern studies and understandings of India in parts of Africa, but also in the Russian Empire, and of course, even in the United States or during the period of the Western expansion. And I think that for in my book, the utility of colonialism is maybe twofold. One is that it, I think it's really important to think about it. It's a useful frame because it really overtly puts us in a conversation with other imperial systems around the same time. So the British, Russian, or French, or other imperial systems. And I think that's important because for a very long time, people talked about Chinese imperial systems in isolation and didn't really think about the ways in which they resembled other imperial formations, but also were often distinct. And I think that what's interesting about putting China in contrast with other imperial systems is that oftentimes we can now see better what was unique or distinct about the Qing formation. The second reason I find colonialism is useful in my book is not because it gives us a quick and reductive understanding of, say, an economic relationship between Tibet and China, or because it assumes necessarily that there was a huge sort of population transfer between China proper and Tibet in the Qing period, which that certainly didn't happen. We had only a very limited number of Chinese or Manchu and other Mongol banner people actually stationed or traveling into Tibet. And really until right down until about 1907 or 1908, the Qing state never had much intention to radically transform Tibet or to incorporate it much more deeply into the provincial system of China proper. So in many levels, I guess I'm sort of going on a tangent here, but in many levels, of course, colonialism does not make immediate sense as an analytical tool for talking about the relationship between Tibet and the Qing. But I think what does make sense is the cultural and intellectual aspect of colonialism. And especially in the second part of my book, what I'm trying to bring to the surface is the degree to which, much like in other imperial systems, the Qing metropole, which was itself a very multicultural metropole full of Manchu, Mongol, Han Chinese officers and officials, they had very idiosyncratic and particularistic views of what Tibetan Buddhism was and what authentic and real Tibetan Buddhism was. And they felt that there were superior forms of knowledge, even when it came to Tibetan Buddhism, entitled them to certain kinds of privileges vis-a-vis Inner Mongolia, Mongolia, and Tibet. And what I really was surprised and fascinated to read in detail about when I began looking through the documents is the degree to which the Qianlong Emperor, many of his officials really felt entitled to kind of edit the Tibetan Buddhist tradition on the basis of a notion that they had a kind of superior form of knowledge. And I think that's the place where the Qing state looks very, very similar to that of the British, particularly in India or the Russians in Central Asia. In both of those other cases, for instance, the imperial metropole and its agents, for instance, had a strong sense that they, through their own systems of knowledge, through their universities and colleges and sort of their philology and their European post-Enlightenment sort of systems of knowledge, that they knew more about Hinduism, for example, or they knew more about Islam than the local people did. And therefore they had a sense of entitlement to sort of reconstruct and create what they felt was a more authentic form of Islam or Hinduism in their colonial territories. And the Qing state is very much, I think, doing something quite similar. It's not just simply patronizing local Tibetan Buddhists. It often was trying to edit their own traditions through massive projects of translation sometimes, but also through projects like the Golden Urn.
All right, this is very interesting. And now maybe let's go into the chapters in the book. It's really interesting that in the book, the chapters are organized in acts and in different themes. So in Act One, the royal regulations, you explore the deliberative process that lay behind the invention of the golden urn in 1792. So how did the Qing state come to possess a monopoly over the arts of divination and prognostication in Tibet and Mongolia and even beyond?
So I think one of the basic purposes of that first act, in addition to sort of trying to figure out, well, where did the idea for the golden urn come from? What did they actually think they were trying to do? And we're talking here about 1791 and 1792, also a little bit of sort of the winter of 1793. And one of the underlying arguments of that chapter is that the attempt to sort of establish what they viewed as a more permanent and secure sovereignty, a more exclusive form of decision making over Tibet, and they used in their own language, in the Manchu language of the sources, this word Tosa, which quite literally in the words of the emperor meant sort of an ultimate decision making authority, this ability to really implement one's decisions and have them be acknowledged and observed. That this desire to establish sovereignty in Tibet was not something which they had been planning and thinking about for a very long time. There was really something about the events of 1790, 1791, 1792 that led them down a chain of sort of discussions that ultimately resulted in the creation of the golden urn, in addition to a large number of other political reforms in Tibet. So really, it's like one of the major goals here is to sort of reestablish this moment, 1792, as a contingent moment, right? We tend to think, if we read a lot of Chinese scholarship, that Chinese control over Tibet was inevitable, that this was some long-term project, that every sort of intervention of the Qing state in Tibet was part of some grand plan, to quote sort of Chinese sources, representing the kind of inevitable and inexorable deepening of relations between Tibet and China proper. But, you know, actually, when you read the sources, there was none of that kind of language is really there. This is much of that is quite retrospective, right? And in fact, some of the primary sources which historians have previously used to discuss 1792, 1793, the invention of the golden urn and sort of the establishment or the attempt to establish greater Qing control over reincarnation and the Gelug Tibetan Buddhist establishment really relies on sources which were written much later. Most importantly, the famous Discourse on Lamas or the Lama Shua. This is a giant stone inscription which now sits in the middle of Beijing at the Yonghegong Temple. So a lot of people look at that inscription, that imperial edict that's inscribed there, and they think, well, this is really what was going on. But in fact, that object and that edict really papers over a whole bunch of sort of contingent discussions and decisions that were made over the course of the years preceding it.
And chapter two, right, kind of continues this discussion in the previous chapter, on the Qing promotion of the golden urn and later the discrediting of the oracles of central Tibet and other indigenous divination practices, right, there. And so this chapter reconstructs the evolution of this campaign into a full-scale even assault on the credibility of the Dalai Lama, right? So how was this carried out and what were the driving forces behind it?
All right, so a good question. Just to take a step back then. So first of all, let me just point out that much of the attempt to regulate and to insert the Qing dynasty or the court or the ruler or the emperor, Qing emperor, into the process of identifying reincarnate lamas began, of course, in the aftermath of the two Gurkha Wars. So in 1788 and then in 1790, 1791, the Gurkhas had invaded Tibet, of course, from what's now modern day Nepal. And After the first invasion, 1788, 1789, actually some of the local Qing officials, along with Tibetans, had proposed a number of policy changes, none of which touched on anything having to do with reincarnation. And then in 1791 and 2, again, most of the Qing local officials, the embans who had been dispatched to Tibet, again, began on a program of sort of thinking, well, how can we restructure the local Tibetan government to make it more capable of resisting outside invasions? The diagnosis of most Qing officials was that actually the Tibetan government, the sort of secular or temporal government, was quite corrupted. They weren't doing a very good job of maintaining any kind of border defense. They had a lot of unsupervised connections with neighboring states like Nepal and Sikkim and Bhutan and so forth. And all of this had been part of the problem that had led to the invasion of the Gurkhas. So basically, the first diagnosis of the reasons for the Gurkha invasions was that, you know, Tibetan government was corrupt and that they hadn't managed their frontiers very well and they hadn't managed their economy very well. And they had been making secret arrangements and conducting secret diplomacy with the Gurkhas. And that was all very problematic. None of this, again, as I say, had anything to do, at least on first glance, with problems about Tibetan Buddhism. Or none of these local officials articulated any interest in creating new laws to regulate reincarnation of high-ranking lamas or chulku. So that first part of my book is really trying to figure out, well, where did this idea come from? Why did the Qing state suddenly become so interested in reincarnation when its officials on the ground were not that interested in reincarnation, right? And so what I find in the first act, looking into the sort of the history of the urn itself, was that when the Qianlong emperor himself and some of his particularly close officials, people that he'd worked with a long time, like He Shen, He Lian, sort of this, actually a group of brothers, in fact, that had been very close to the emperor for many years, it was really this small group of people who began to feel that the corruption of the Tibetan government went much, much deeper than just simply political problems or economic problems, and that part of the problem lay in the fact that they began to perceive that some of the leading reincarnate monks of the Tibetan Buddhist Church or the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism were in fact not really authentic. And that as they dug into that problem or that perceived problem even further, they came to believe that some of these inauthentic monks were being identified and supported by the oracles of Central Tibet. So the Central Tibetan government had often relied very heavily, in fact, almost always relied to a certain extent on at least four different oracles located in and around Lhasa to help them deliberate and make decisions on both matters of politics and also matters of religious affairs. And so the Qianlong Emperor, several of his closest officials really came to believe that not only were many of the leading reincarnated monks of Tibet perhaps not authentic, not who they claimed to be or who others claimed them to be, but also that behind that was a system of corrupted oracles or corrupted oracular governance through divination, governance through oracles, that had sort of corrupted the overall system. So the real goal of the Qing state in 1792 and 93 was to either regulate or eliminate that system of reliance on local oracles. And when we talk about oracles in specific, what we're talking about is individuals who had the capacity to become vessels for local protector deities in Tibet. You have an oracle, they go into their trance and they become possessed by a particular protector deity, and they can be then asked questions. And the oracle, the system of oracles is even more complicated than that, because oftentimes the oracles, they don't speak very clearly. They speak in tongues or they give strange signals. And so the oracles themselves are usually accompanied by a variety of assistants who then provide interpretation kind of in real time for whatever it is the oracles are saying and doing. So you have this system in the Qing state. Look, when they began to dig into it, they really thought it was highly problematic on multiple levels. They weren't. And so the golden urn was really intended behind the scenes as a way to supplant, to replace those oracles with a system that was more reliable, perhaps, and more easily supervised by the Qing state. And so the second act of my book really goes into a kind of a campaign to persuade Tibetans and Mongols that the golden urn as a tool for divination, as a kind of a divination technology, was more reliable than the oracles were.
I see. And this is also a kind of assault on the credibility of the Dalai Lama?
Yeah, which was quite surprising to me, actually, to read about in the historical sources. And I should say, I actually read up on to begin this discussion, is that in Manchu and Chinese language sources, we see a lot of interesting stories or accounts of encounters between the Qing state and the Dalai Lama and the oracles. None of this information is visible to my, as far as I can tell, from Tibetan sources. So, you know, there may be a danger here, both in my book and in any further discussion, about an over-reliance on Qing official sources about some events, which I can find very little reference to in local sources, at least with regards to the events of 1793. So in 1793, the Qing court became aware of another search for another reincarnation in Mongolia. And this was a search for a Trulku, or a reincarnate lama known as the Erdeni Pandita. And this was an incarnate lineage located in central sort of outer Mongolia. And they'd received, actually, this case came to their attention because they'd received a petition, actually, from the treasurer of this particular reincarnation's estate, requesting that the state recognize a new reincarnation. And this reincarnation, of course, had not been selected or identified at all using the urn. And the Qing state began to dig into this. And it increasingly became their perception that this case, the search for this Erdeni Pandita Lama, was actually a textbook example, in their opinion, of corruption. The treasurer, for instance, from their perspective, had traveled multiple times to central Tibet. He'd given the oracles lots and lots of money. The oracles at first had not really recognized or not given clear advice. And this, the treasurer had come back with, you know, a list of names. The treasurer had prioritized the names. The names happened to be the names of, you know, other elite Mongol princes. You know, coincidence. He gave lots of money again to the oracles, and then, you know, oh, what a coincidence, the oracles identified, you know, the leading sort of local aristocrat as a reincarnation. I'm oversimplifying this a little bit, but from the perspective of the Qing state, this was just a textbook case of collusion between local monks, the oracles, and local nobles out in Mongolia. And the real danger here, from the perspective of the Qing state, was not necessarily that they were worried about local nobles or notables in Mongolia or Tibet gaining power by being identified as reincarnate monks, right? But really, the fear of the Qing state was that if this kind of activity went on, they really worried that people wouldn't actually find the reincarnate monks credible anymore, right? If everyone was just getting reincarnated in the households of rich families, it seemed like it left a really bad impression. And this wasn't just simply an impression shared by the Qing state. What I found really remarkable in doing the archival research is that the Qing state was consulting with leading Tibetan Buddhist monks as well. And these Tibetan Buddhist monks, at least from what I can read in the sources, shared the Qing state's perception that many of these reincarnate lamas were not in fact authentic, and that there was indeed pretty serious corruption among the process of finding reincarnate lamas. And actually, this kind of sense of doubt about reincarnation can be found in a lot of different Tibetan sources. A very prominent, for instance, monk, Sumpa Kempo, kind of a polymath, a very prominent lama from what's now modern-day Qinghai, had also wrote extensively in his collected works about doubts about, you know, the authenticity of various prominent lamas. The great fifth Dalai Lama himself, in his own autobiography, has sort of joked that even he might not be an authentic reincarnation. So these kinds of sort of cynical views of reincarnation were out there in the ether among Tibetan Buddhists themselves, and the Qing state was aware of those rhetorics, but it was also deeply concerned about what would happen if all of a sudden there was great and growing debate about the authenticity of these monks, because these monks were always much more than just monks. In many parts of Tibet and Mongolia, the monks were also important local administrators. And so there was great worry about what would happen if their control fractured. So there was this deep concern about local stability, because the governance of much of Inner Asia really relied on the Tibetan Buddhist Church. So if the Tibetan Buddhist Church started to fracture over the question of the authenticity of its leadership, that was, of course, something which really scared the Qing state. So, right, to circle back to the beginning of this rather long-winded answer, the Qing state used the case of the Erdeni Pandita Lama from Mongolia as both a test of the Golden Urn ritual and as an opportunity to see, to sort of promote their new ritual across Mongolia and Tibet. And in the midst of this, it involved things like interrogating the Dalai Lama, of trying to delegitimize the oracles in Tibet by subjecting them to public trials, in which they were forced to do things they obviously couldn't do in public. So it was a fairly sophisticated, fairly empire-wide. This was an effort that went from far outer Mongolia all the way to Lhasa, all the way to parts of what are modern-day Sichuan, so Kham and Amdo. It was really a very comprehensive effort to persuade Tibetan Buddhists and Mongol and Tibetan aristocrats and maybe even lay, sort of average lay people that that the Golden Urn was an appropriate tool, divination tool, that could be substituted for the oracles.
All right, thank you. This is a really important part of the book and part of important part of your argument overall as well. And chapter two, or act two rather, is entitled Shamanic Colonialism. What do you mean by shamanic colonialism here? Can you explain for us a little bit?
Yeah, so shamanic colonialism obviously has two parts, shamanism and colonialism. And as I said earlier in the interview, like one of the things which struck me as so emblematic about the Qing state's efforts to control Tibet and Mongolia, and it's similar to the efforts of, say, Russia or Britain to control their colonial peripheries, was a kind of hierarchy of knowledge. And when the Qing state went out and argued, sometimes really to itself, actually, in its own sort of discussions, but also in public edicts, it argued that it knew divination, or it understood the oracles, and it understood the Tibetan tradition on oracular governance or on the use of divination much better than Mongols and Tibetans did themselves. And when the Qing state looked at the oracles, what they saw were shamans. And the Manchus were familiar with shamans because their own tradition, even before they'd entered into the passes and taken over China, shamanism and shamans had played an important part in Manchu culture. And one of the kind of fascinating things I found in both really Qing private discussions among themselves, secret discussions about these procedures is the degree to which they really viewed the Tibetans as bad shamans, and that they thought their own tradition of shamanism, their own knowledge of shamanism, now interwoven with sort of their own understandings of Tibetan Buddhism, meant that they really were the legitimate people when it came to making decisions about what kinds of divination were legitimate and what kinds of divination was illegitimate. So they were really often overtly comparing their own tradition to the tradition of Tibet when it came to divination.
I see. And then in addition to that, your book mentions that there is also the other perspective, Neo-Confucians, right, in the Qing courts, with regard to these either shamanic or oracle practices, right?
Yeah, so I do think that when we get to the 1780s and 1790s, the concerns which the Qing state had when it approached the governance of China were beginning to influence the way it approached the governance of Inner Asia as well. And I think that this is one of the places I hope where the book gets a little bit interesting for some readers, is that especially readers familiar with history, the literature on the new Qing history or the study of the Qing state as an empire, may find this perhaps important in that, a prevailing view of the Qing state is that it had these kind of very autonomous constituencies, right? It governed the Mongols through, in a particular way. It governed the Tibetans in a particular way. It governed Islamic sort of Central Asia in a different, unique way, and then it governed China through sort of the culture and language of Confucian sagehood. So when the Qing state looked at different parts of its empire, it looked at different parts of the empire with different kinds of cultural discourses or different kinds of languages, right? But that may have held true for much of the 1600s or the 1700s. But I think by the 1780s and 1790s, both the emperor and many of his important officials who were busy working on Inner-Asia policy were increasingly influenced and looking at Inner-Asia from a Confucian perspective. And one of the other reasons which probably drove their interest in divination was a more traditional view of emperorship based on Confucian traditions of emperorship, which really argued that the emperor was and should be the sole pivot between heaven and earth, that the imperial Chinese state needed to monopolize divination. And this was something which the Qing state now had to do in Inner Asia. It was not that concerned with local divination practices up until I think really the 1790s. But in the 1790s, the Qing state was very concerned now with divination, and that I think reflected some of its historical concerns that it always had with rule within China proper.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. And in chapter 3 or act 3, Ando was speaking in code, you give a case study of the monastic university situated in Amdo, right, a place right at the crossroads of China, Tibet, and Mongolia, the Labron Tashikyo Monastery. And here you look at the tension between the monastery leadership's desire to locate the rebirth of their founding Lama according to their own procedures, right, and then the Qing Emperor Qianlong's covert operation in opposition, on the other hand. So how was this tension negotiated, and what was the role of the Golden Urn in this case?
So this is a case from 1795, 96, and 1797. And this case involves a reincarnate Lama called the Jamyang Shepa, who was really probably one of the most prominent reincarnate Lamas or Trokhu in the Amdo region, but was really one of the most important influential figures and really throughout Inner Asia. And so the death of this monk, the second generation of that monk in the early 1790s, and the search for his successor was of enormous political and religious significance to the Qing state. And this is really perhaps the most important test of the urn that had come since it was invented in 1792. So this is about 4 or 5 years after the initial invention of the urn ritual. And so this was, it was important to the Qing state. It was important because they wanted to set a precedent. And of course, it was important because this guy was very politically and religiously significant. I think it's also important because they never stated this in their in any of the documents I read, but they could not have been ignorant of the fact that this monk's community had been divided very, very dangerously already once in the past. The search for the second generation of this monk had been very, very divisive in Amdo and had resulted in the division of the monastic community and the establishment of really competing candidates and, in fact, some considerable violence. So really, this case was a good example to the Qing state of just the kinds of damage that could be done if there wasn't a clear and smooth and convincing candidate to replace or to succeed the former monk. So in this particular case, what I thought was really, so this is one of the cases I have to say which was exciting to me and I never expected to write about. This is a case that really, the significance of this all emerged just reading Manchu language materials. And when I was reading the sort of the secret Manchu language reports from Amdo and Tibet, they talked about this search. And in some of the earlier reports, they actually were requests from local Tibetan and then Manchu officials to allow the monastery to identify its own candidate. In fact, the Manchu official in the region reported that sort of 1796 that the community had already settled on a new candidate. They'd already identified the successor. And this official wrote to the Qing state sort of requesting a waiver, requesting that the Qing state not implement the golden urn. When the ruler read about this, he wrote again some secret messages to Lhasa and said, no, look, we need to handle this, but that child cannot be the one that's selected. And so seeing in the Manchu materials this information, I realized or found something which I'd never seen before in the Tibetan language chronicles. So the Tibetan language chronicles write about the emergence of a different candidate as the legitimate candidate, and they don't mention any kind of controversy. So what was really fascinating was that the Manchu sources revealed a controversy that the Tibetan language sources had obscured. And so the argument that I make here in this chapter is that using a variety of rhetorical and other devices, it was really actually local Tibetan elites who helped the Qing state legitimize the golden urn ritual for the local community. And that this process didn't just happen overnight. It actually required almost a century of writing. So Tibetan Buddhist authors and historians at this monastery actually were forced to write multiple times over 100 years in ways which worked to eradicate any knowledge that the community actually originally had a different candidate as its preferred successor. So I think that was for me really quite interesting. So it was discovering in the Manchu materials that there was in fact originally a different candidate that had been strongly supported by this monastic community, and that the Tibetan sources completely ignored that candidate and wrote about the one which the Qing state had ultimately selected. So I thought that was really actually quite an interesting story, and especially because it goes against many of the assumptions we have based on sort of modern nationalist accounts of Tibetan history. So this wasn't a case of Tibetans resisting the Qing state. It was a case of Tibetans working in ways that actually assisted the Qing state and legitimized this ritual, although they may not have seen it in those lights. And here we see also that the Qin state sort of successfully getting its way in a place where it didn't have a whole lot of power.
Yeah, this part is indeed really interesting. And I think your use of these Manchu archival sources are, you know, heavily understudied, really brings a fresh perspective on these issues. And so in this chapter, you reveal the codes, right, by which Qing elites, both Manchu and Tibetan, communicated. Can you speak more about this discovery and what you mean by codes? How did these work?
Yeah, so what I kind of began to sense is that, so even in the Tibetan language sources, there's sort of, you can read them on two levels. You can read them as we all have traditionally read them, for instance, these biographies of Tibetan monks or of this particular monk, as sort of a simplistic account of his discovery, his legitimacy, his career, and so on. But if you know, actually, on the basis of Manchu sources, that this guy's legitimacy was actually quite controversial, when you reread the Tibetan language sources, you actually find little clues. Sometimes they're actually not even that subtle. And so one gets the sense that Tibetans who were in the know or who had witnessed these events were still leaving traces of their concerns about, for instance, this particular identification process. They're leaving traces which would only be visible to other people who kind of knew other sort of Qing period elites. So for example, in one of the, in the biography of a gentleman who was tasked with traveling to, a Tibetan gentleman who's tasked with traveling to Lhasa to oversee the selection of his leading monk, the Zhanyang Shepo, and who got to know the Anban, the Qing officials in Lhasa, and also got to know and talk with the regent, the Tibetan regent in Lhasa, and supervised or sort of was there witnessing the Golden Urn ritual. We have recorded, you know, or manufactured a conversation between him and the regent in which he says this. It's really fascinating. And so the regent says, asks him, so what do you think about the various candidates? So there's sort of two or three candidates. And the regent says, I've heard that the first candidate is the one which is very promising. And the man from the locality says, he doesn't say anything. He sort of hedges and he says, well, as you know, they're all good candidates, and we Amdawas speak in code, and the Kampas, the people from the Kams region, sort of feign ignorance. And so you can see here in this sort of very coy conversation signals that all was not well, right, with this search process. Now, I think most readers would just sort of skim over that, particularly 100 years later. But those people who had witnessed these events or had been around Lebrun Monastery, the home of the Zhanyang Shepo in the 1790s, early 1800s, probably would have been a little bit aware of this. Also, the other interesting thing is that we learn a lot here, too, about the circulation of information within Inner Asia. And what was really impressive to me was that you have reports from the Qing state, which were not really public, were not meant to be public. These were not edicts. These were letters, reports written by local officials to the Qing state, which you could find quoted in their entirety in Tibetan historical materials. So the sense that the Qing state was actually tolerating or even leaking particular forms of information very strategically. Another good example of this is the fact that I found drafts of letters which were written by leading Tibetan monks in Beijing, which were addressed to the Dalai Lama in Lhasa, in which these monks in Beijing were trying to assure the Dalai Lama that the Golden Urn and other sort of current interventions in Tibet were, in fact, well-meaning and that they were very legitimate and that they had kind of a historical basis to them or a sort of theological basis within Tibetan Buddhism. And again, here you sort of see, and these were letters, the drafts were written in Manchu, and it sort of very clearly seems to me that the Qing state was probably quite overtly, you know, using Tibetans to write, you know, having them write letters back to Tibet to conduct propaganda on their behalf. So, you know, there's this really fascinating way in which this case allows us to see just how certain kinds of information circulated and certain information didn't, and how people had to speak in kind of code, often to communicate some of the problems they observed, but also the ways in which the Qing state could very, very use in a very sophisticated fashion Tibetan Buddhist elites themselves to get its message across.
Wow, this is really fascinating material, and this really nuanced reading of their communications. It's definitely one of the highlights of the book. So I urge our listeners to pick up a copy and read more of these examples. And in the conclusion, Paradoxes of the Urn and the Limits of Empire, you point out paradoxes, right, of the Golden Urn tradition and even some unexpected implications brought on by the tradition that highlights both the creative agencies of Tibetan Buddhists on one hand and as well as limitations of the Qing Empire on the other. Can you speak a bit more about this?
Yeah, and, you know, the conclusion is really trying to do, I want to make one thing really clear, and I'm not even sure that my conclusion does this super successfully, and it's that I don't want to overstate the significance of the urn. This is just one small ritual or law that had a kind of a limited impact within Tibetan Buddhist regions. This is one small aspect of the policy. What I find really remarkable, though, nonetheless, is that, as I've already mentioned, is that so on many levels, it seemed like the Qing state was actually remarkably successful in taking actually what had been originally a Ming period or a Chinese bureaucratic ritual, which was originally intended. Was used within the Board of Civil Appointments to hand out or to allocate sort of jobs within the Chinese bureaucracy. That was where this ritual came from originally, and it was exported to Tibet, and somehow through the efforts of both the Qing officials and through local Tibetan elites, it became a Tibetan ritual, a Tibetan Buddhist ritual, a divination tool. And so that transformation is pretty impressive. And I think it sort of demonstrates kind of some of the reasons why the Qing state's control over places like Mongolia and Tibet was really durable and how its rule could be sustained well into, you know, the early 20th century. But I also wanted to point out that this was, you know, its rule was limited, indirect. And one of the reasons why Tibetan Buddhist elites, I think, supported this ritual and the Qing state more generally is because they really reaped a lot of benefits from imperial patronage and from the overall framework that the empire provided. You know, I think that it's worthwhile to pause and remember that over the course of the 200 years that, you know, the Qing state sort of dominated Inner Asia, say from the 1750s when they finally defeated the major competitor there, the Jungar Mongols, all the way down to the early 20th century, they really provided a kind of environment in which the Gelug Church, the leading school of Tibetan Buddhism, could really expand and profit in ways that were unprecedented. And the other thing is that I think a lot of our assumptions about sort of Sino-Tibetan relations derive from a kind of sense of a conflict between China and Tibet, and that that the Tibetans, you know, took every opportunity possible to diminish and avoid or mitigate sort of Qing or Chinese influence within Lhasa or other parts of Tibet, and that they fundamentally thought that any sort of interventions the Qing state took were, of course, would be at their expense. And I think that sort of narrative is fundamentally wrong. I think that the Tibetan elites accurately perceive the Qing state as actually often working to enhance their own local power. In other words, the Qing state was often working to enhance the power of Tibetan elites over their own indigenous political and religious systems. And the Golden Urn was a good example of that, because it was an effort to homogenize and regulate the processes by which people identified reincarnations. And I think that many Tibetan elites were very sympathetic to that effort. They wanted to see these processes centralized under the control of the government in Lhasa, and then by default, the government in Beijing. And it also played into the notions of an expanded Greater Tibet, because the Qing state, in the context of the Golden Urn, gave Tibetan elites in Lhasa the privilege of supervising reincarnations now from regions well outside of the areas traditionally governed by the Lhasa government. So Amdo and Kham, incarnations from Amdo and Kham were now required to, at least high-ranking ones, were required to have the Golden Urn procedure conducted in Lhasa. So I think that the Golden Urn ritual, quite paradoxically, actually played into the deeper desires of the Gelug school and other Tibetan elites for their own kind of political and religious power.
Oh, very interesting. And so lastly, what has been the role of the Golden Urn in the People's Republic of China then, and maybe its role in the future?
That's really a subject for another book. And originally, actually, I thought about writing a book about reincarnation in 20th century China. I think I won't, because it required too much research. And it's also really difficult to, we don't have archival access, of course, to contemporary China and the Chinese Communist Party and to its inner policymaking process, like we did for the Qing period. But anyways, I think one point I would make is that the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party resurrected the Golden Urn ritual in 1995. And even then, I don't think, much like in the 1790s, I don't think that they really thought this through. I don't think that the Chinese Communist Party had been planning for decades to roll out the Golden Urn when the next Dalai Lama or Panchen Lama died. And the reason I say that is because there wasn't really, the Golden Urn was not a prominent feature. Like, there weren't that many Chinese-based scholars talking about it prior to 1995. It really didn't seem to be on the radar. It seems to me that in the crisis that the Chinese government faced in 1995, when you had the Dalai Lama overseas announcing his own candidate, that they had to scramble for some tool by which to maintain control of the process. And of course, they want to maintain control of the process of identifying reincarnate Trolku or Lamas for two important reasons. First of all, because it's extraordinarily important for their rhetorical claims of sovereignty in Tibet. But secondly, because they need to control this process, because they need to physically control the bodies of future reincarnate Lamas. They need these people to stay within China. They need to be subjected to so-called, quote-unquote, patriotic education. The Chinese government needs to be confident that future reincarnate lamas are people they can trust. They don't want a repeat of I think it's the 13th Karmapa. They don't want a repetition of the 14th Dalai Lama. They don't want prominent Gelug or other, Tibetan Buddhist monks in exile in other parts of the world, expounding on the flaws of the Chinese political system, or God forbid, claiming that Tibet or Mongolia or other places are independent from China. So they're desperate to make sure that when a child is announced, they have the child, that they can take that child to Beijing and that they can educate that child and control that child in ways that they see appropriate. So the Golden Urn will remain extremely important, because it's sort of a convenient tool by which the Chinese government can say, we legitimately have a right to to be involved in this process.
Oh, I see. Well, Dr. Roitman, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you so much for sharing your incredible research with us. This was a really, really great book. And thank you for, sending the book to me, and I really enjoyed reading the whole thing. Before we conclude our interview, however, could you tell us a bit more about your current research projects? What have you been working on recently?
So, as I said at the beginning of the interview, I'm kind of going back now to my original project, which is using local sources from modern-day Qinghai and Gansu to understand the broader history of sort of local society and especially legal culture in Tibet or in Gansu and Qinghai from the 1600s down to the mid-20th century. And I think this is important because I think that there's been a view that Tibetan society has been highly autonomous from neighboring societies, and particularly from any kinds of interventions by the Qing state. And if the Golden Urn is a good example of a way in which aspects of Tibetan society were changed in important ways, I think that I've been finding that the Qing state was deeply involved in the local legal culture of Tibetan communities, particularly in Amdo and Tom, really from the mid 1700s right down into the end of the dynasty. And this is something which people haven't really seen before, largely because they really haven't had access to kind of local documents. And what I think is kind of exciting is that about these sources and about the story I'm trying to tell in this new book is that really the interaction between local Tibetans and Qing period legal forums played an important role both in inventing a new notion of quote unquote traditional Tibetan law, but also really had a big impact on daily lives. So people's pious activities, their trips to monasteries, the interactions between monasteries, the questions of property rights, succession, all of these things were questions were often, but not always, resolved through recourse to Qing legal institutions. So it's a kind of an interesting set of historical processes, which I don't think that people have really seen before. And so it's been exciting to read these kinds of sources. So the new book is going to be called, it's hopefully going to be out next year, it's called When Tibetans Came to Court, sort of a history of Tibetan legal culture on the Sino-Tibetan frontier.
Great. That sounds like a really interesting project. I think our listeners will certainly be looking forward to it. And when your new book comes out, hopefully we'll get to interview again. And finally, I want to thank you for being on the show today. This has been a great interview. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay, great. All right. So take care.